Hey everyone, we are still working on coming up with a musical intro for our podcast. Thanks for the people who have sent some stuff in. Though it occurred to me that adding a musical intro can only be done after we're done recording, so I don't think it's going to help us make be any less awkward with these introductions. So anyways, the LL Podcast, already in progress.
If anything, you'd think that having music, if it's really good music, you'd be like, wow, this is a professional podcast, and then we'd start talking, they'd be like, whoa, this is an amateur podcast, and then, you know, so it would just emphasize how bad we are at these introductions. So maybe, okay, if anything, maybe our plan should be start with really shitty music,
yeah,
and we'll sound professional.
That's a good idea. So if anybody wants to throw in some Casio, some MIDIs... Yeah, you know, 1970s theme song-ish genre.
Josh Groban?
Yeah, sure. So anyways, news! Yes!
News!
Woo!
Hit me with news.
News!
Hit me faster.
So, okay, Russell Brannion. Russell Brannion is...
Russell Brannion.
Has... There's no news, but there's rumors. And the rumors are that he, what is it, the Indians and the Rays it's come down to?
Indians and Rays are in there. He also was either sniffed or not sniffed by the Marlins, which is a weird way of putting it. I'd take that back. And also the Red Sox were in there very briefly, but I guess they've dropped out. So the rumors right now are that it's Indians versus Rays. And the jobs that he would be in line for in Cleveland, he would be backing up Matt LaPorta, that hot prospect they got from Milwaukee, who's coming off some minor surgery. And in Tampa Bay, he would be splitting DH, at least at first, with Pat Burrell.
Correct. That's what I've heard as well.
Yeah.
So the Indians thing, that he'd be playing the field, potentially.
Yes. And I think I saw some, I forgot which team it was for, but I saw some connection that he could even be in, end up in right field for somebody.
I believe that was the Indians as well.
Okay, so they would be using him as a backup first baseman and emergency outfielder or something.
Right. Which yeah, that was surprising, especially after he's gone all winter not even being able to sniff a job offer, and then all of a sudden he seems to be zeroing in on some serious offers, and the offers have him playing the field, which obviously we didn't even want. It seemed like the Mariners were too hesitant to even give him a partial DH first base job.
Right. It makes you wonder, so right now, somebody will sign Brandy and say, and give him a little time in the field, and then there's going to be Mariners fans who say, well, look, he can clearly play the field. They signed him to play the field. Teams aren't stupid. The Mariners should have signed him for first base, because let's face it, he's better than Casey Kotchman. But what you have to consider as a Mariners fan is that the team who knows the most about him made him an offer, and he didn't take it, and he left, and they didn't follow it up, even when they had a need at first base. Because presumably the Mariners see something they really don't like. And I would think that the other teams have been able to look at his medical files and all that, but I still think the Mariners have some greater insight than the Tampa Bay or Cleveland. Or maybe they're just more willing to take a risk. It could also be that. But I don't think we can look at this and think that the Mariners screwed up. I think they have a good reason for doing what they did or not doing what they did. And I think it worked out okay. And really, the best we can do is just to wish Brannion the best of luck, because he's an awesome player, an awesome guy, and I hope that he ends up in Tampa Bay.
Right, yeah. We want to guard against any premature judging of the Mariners for not signing Russell Brannion, even if he goes on to have another stellar year. Each team is different. The risk profile that the Rays can accept, much like with the A's and Ben Sheets, the Rays are kind of in a situation where they need to hit a home run on a couple people to pass the Red Sox and the Yankees. So for them, adding a Russell Brannion makes all sorts of sense, whereas for us, we kind of already had all those risks on our roster, and we kind of needed to mitigate against some of it. And Casey Kotchman made more sense in that respect. You know, it may not end up working out that way, but that's the nature of risks and what you have to take.
What I think is interesting is that a few places I've seen have said between Tampa Bay and Cleveland, Brannion is picking between more playing time in Cleveland and a chance at the playoffs with Tampa Bay. And I don't know. I mean, I guess the argument is that behind LaPorta's young, he was hurt, he's no sure thing, that Brannion could sneak into some playing time. But in Tampa Bay, he would be paired with Pat Burrell at DH. And I don't know if anybody has checked out Pat Burrell's stat line from last year, but it has all the hallmarks of a guy who just sucks now and is not going to have that long of a leash. So while if Pat Burrell rebounds, Branning's just looking at a bench job in Tampa Bay, I would think that Tampa Bay offers both the greatest shot at a regular role and the greatest shot at the playoffs. So to me, it's more a matter of, do I want to have the chance to do more in Tampa Bay, or do I just want to go home? And I don't actually know where Brandon's from, but he spent about 9 years with the Indians organization, so it could be familiar to him.
That's a good point. Burrell's a righty, correct?
Yes.
So even if he rebounds, I think you still have a situation where Brandon would have a platoon role at DH, at least partially, part of the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm also not even sure if the Rays offer him a better chance at the playoffs. They're obviously a better team. They're a much better team. But the AL Central is nowhere near the AL East. Mm-hmm. Now, Minnesota is a pretty good team, I believe, and I don't really know the relative strength, but it wouldn't surprise me all that much if, odds of winning the division-wise, the Indians have a better chance of finishing ahead than the Rays, even if there's a greater gap between the Indians' true talent level and the Twins' true talent level than there is between the Rays and the Red Sox and the Yankees. The matter of the Rays having to overcome probably both the Red Sox and the Yankees to win the division versus the Indians only probably having to overcome the Twins. I don't think there's really a huge other threat in that division.
I don't know. The Tigers might get Johnny Damon.
Right.
I'm trying to pull up a post on Beyond the Box Score that was just doing some playoff odds posts a little while ago. And if you give me a second, I can track them down. But
that's fine. I will
also,
fill.
Sorry?
No, I said I could fill. But then you kept talking, so.
Here we go. Well, this is just using Pacoda. This is really no good.
Yeah,
well, let's go ahead. Let's just get some idea where the Rays end up with a 46% chance of the playoffs and Cleveland ends up at 13.
How much of that percentage does it break down between division and wild card?
Cleveland has 12% division and Tampa Bay has 23, because it puts Tampa Bay as only 4 wins behind the Yankees, 2 behind the Red Sox. But I don't know. Looking at the Indians, their rotation is Westbrook, Carmona, Masterson, Huff, and Laffey.
Wow, that's
granted,
bad.
I haven't done any number crunching on that. But that's a lot of ground ballers. Actually, that is a lot of... Holy shit, that is a ton of ground ball. Who the hell is David Huff? I'm going to assume David Huff is a slop-throwing ground baller. So they clearly have a mold. Regardless, Indians, I think, are still a longer shot than the Rays. Brandon's best bet would be Tampa Bay, but he lived so long in Cleveland that who knows, maybe that's what he wants. But he's only been in the playoffs twice, so...
What does he know? And, you know, there could be significant monetary incentives or whatever. You know, there's a lot of stuff we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. David Huff is a slop-throwing, not ground baller.
Oh, no. So he's bad.
Well, he's only had 1 year in the majors was last year. He made about 20 or so starts, if I remember, but he didn't strike anybody out.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that, but he was pretty neutral ground ball fly ball ratio.
Okay.
I think he had some minor league success, though, before that, so he might have just been, you know, first dibs up.
I'm looking at the Indians right now, and while this will not be our 40-man rundown of the podcast, probably, they have this catcher named Lou Marson.
And I remember Lou Marson. He used to play for the Red Sox.
You remember Lou Marlone.
Oh, you're right. It's Lou Marlone.
The other Lou Mer. This Lou Marson has the name of a man twice his age because this Lou Marson is 23 years old, which is a very peculiar name for a 23-year-old because you would associate it with, like, your grown-up barber.
Yeah, there's not a lot of Lou's out there anymore.
Oh, he's a handsome fellow. Wow. So, okay, other news, sort of. But not news at all. Other rumors, I guess, is the whole Jared Walshman situation, which I guess we might as well talk about, even though there's nothing currently going on.
Not at all. Yeah, there's nothing. It's like the opposite of the daily Mark Pryor updates from 2005. There's just no news. Stays the same, but there's no news.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what's kind of brought it to attention to some people is the post that Dave wrote a week ago or so, advocating how Jared Washburn could make sense as a fifth starter for the first half of the year and then a left-handed reliever for the remainder of the year because Jared Washburn does have pretty significant platoon splits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I would say is, logically, I think the idea makes tons of sense. Jared Washburn has very little suitors, it seems like, although we are seeing sort of a, I guess, a rebound in the market. But there feels like there's a chance that you could get him cheaper than his value would indicate. And I think he could have success in that role, and he would kind of give us a little, he would give us more starting pitching depth, which is always good, and give us, you know, a slight upgrade at the fifth starter to start the year, some more protection if Eric Bedard never comes back. And if Eric Bedard does come back, in theory, he would make a good left-handed reliever.
Mm-hmm.
My problems with that are that I don't think Jared Washburn wants to be a reliever.
Mm-hmm.
Jared Washburn's been pretty outspoken already before. We saw this with the Jojima stuff and other incidents while he was a Mariner. So I don't think he's the ideal person to just kind of shut up and take his role. And I think even if he found himself in the situation where he had to take a relief role in order to find a job, coming back to the Mariners where he's been for the last 4 years and accepting a new contract with a demotion,
mm-hmm.
for better or worse, I think that's even harder for him to do. I think it'd be easier if I put myself in Jared Washburn's shoes and added some rationality to it and realized that I was facing being a reliever in Minnesota or Milwaukee or Detroit or Chicago or St. Louis versus being – or Baltimore. Or the Astros.
Oh, lots of hunting.
Yeah. Oh, Roy Oswalt. Actually, those two would get along.
Would they?
Oh, boy.
Yeah,
anyways.
You know how those Southerners are.
If I was facing the choice between a reliever in any other city and going back to Seattle and being a reliever, I feel like I would hedge away from accepting Seattle because you'd be coming back to a clubhouse and a fan base where you've been before, where you kind of had some good years, that's used to you as being a starter, and then now you'd be a reliever. And it's just kind of tantamount to admitting that you have gotten worse. Everything else is the same, and it's not, but I feel like this is how it would be interpreted. You're coming back to the same city, you were on the team last year, you were a starter last year, you were an important starter for the team last year. Now you're back, and now you're the fifth man in the bullpen. That's a tough... I mean, the image is going to be that he got demoted.
Mm-hmm.
And Jared Washburn doesn't strike me as the sort of person who would take to that role.
All right, so my counterpoint would be... Well, there would be a couple of counterpoints. For one thing, Jared Washburn has also been outspoken about how he's considered retirement. He is probably pretty aware that he isn't what he used to be. In fact, that's why he was going to retire last year, right? Baseball wasn't fun anymore. He didn't feel like he was on top of his game, all that stuff. I think he's open to coming back to Seattle. It seems like at this point he would... I don't know if that Twins offer is still on the table, that $5 million offer that was rumored to be out there.
Yeah, I think if that was still out there, he would have taken it.
Yeah, that was... Whoops! I would think he's probably... He knows what Seattle did for him. He's not stupid, Jared Washburn. He knows he's a lefty fly ball guy. He pitched in this ballpark in front of that defense for most of the year. He knows Seattle's a good environment for him. He's comfortable with the team and the city. I think the city started to embrace him last year, for better or worse, and for right or wrong. So I think he would be open to coming back. And the other thing you have to consider is the idea that Dave brought up was that Washburn would move to the bullpen when Bedard comes back. And in an ideal world, that's true, because then you have, you know, Felix Lee, Bedard, Snell, RRS, and Washburn has nowhere to go. But what do you think are the odds that we get to whenever, late June, July, and all five of those starters are still going?
Probably pretty low.
Pretty low, and I'm not going to sit here and predict that any one starter will have trouble, but the odds of having any one starter out of action at any one given time are actually really high, especially for Felix, who threw 250 innings last year, for Lee, who threw 500 innings last year. RRS has never thrown a whole bunch of innings. Snell could keep on sucking. Bedard could never come back, you know? The Mariners would approach Washburn with an offer and be like, hey, we want you to be our fifth starter. We think you're a good fit here, and there's a chance if Bedard comes back at full strength and everybody else is going well, you could be shifted to the bullpen where you would be given a prominent role as the first lefty. And, I mean, Washburn would still be throwing critical pitches every other day. So they would clearly make him aware of the possibility, but then Washburn would be choosing between that and nothing. And I don't know if he wants to retire. I think he would be open to that if it were presented to him, but I don't know. I don't know Jared Washburn as a person, and if I did, I would hunt.
Well, those are really good points.
Well, thanks.
I don't have a counter to that so much. I think that's a good discussion about Jared Washburn. I would say that you did assuage some of my concerns, hypothetical concerns, since it's not like we did actually sign him or that we've been rumored to sign him, but yeah, I do feel like if he was signed to be the fifth starter, he probably, even if he does end up in the bullpen for a stretch, he probably still ends up around 150 innings, because you bring up a good point about not just Eric Bedard, but Ian Snell. Really, Eric Bedard coming back, Ian Snell needs to stay healthy and not be the Ian Snell that we've seen. And then the combined likelihood of injury between Felix, Cliff Lee, and Ryan Rollinsmith is probably, as you say, the odds of all three of them being healthy for the entire year is probably not superb.
Mm-hmm.
Just in general. I mean, any three starting pitchers, the odds of all three of them being healthy for the entire season, it's no matter who they are, really not that good.
Right. So. Six starters pick up a lot of innings. And, you know, even if Washington did have to go to the bullpen at first, when Bedard comes back, it doesn't mean nobody's going to go on the DL later. So if he wouldn't be signed, he almost certainly wouldn't just go to the bullpen after Bedard comes back and stay there. And even if he did, he would get his big innings. He would make an impact. I don't know. If he were approached, I think he would do it. But I don't know if we actually have any money left anyway.
Yeah. Well, I like the idea, as I said when I read it. My only reservations were personality reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And while I think you bring up good points, again, who really knows? That really comes down to Washburn, Wakamatsu, and Zarenczyk, and right. Probably, I guess, Rick Adair. But I think that's a pretty good wrap on Washburn. So I wanted to talk about in this post that you just wrote. I say just because we're recording this at 3 p.m. on Wednesday. I don't know when this will actually get posted on Lookout Landing.
Oh.
So that you just wrote about this kind of this, well, you wrote it. You summarize it.
So a couple days ago, John Sickles, who many of you would know as this minor league wizard, he's been writing about the minor leagues and prospects for as long as I've been alive, for however long that is. That's 24 years. Nice job, Jeff. So Sickles is well known in the minor league field, and he came out with a post on his blog the other day about how he's reaching this point where he's becoming, I don't know if the best word is disinterested or disillusioned by a lot of this new baseball statistical talk and all the research going on, because if you look around the baseball community right now, there is a lot more research going on than there is creative writing or, I don't know, scouting insight. Everybody is trying to, everybody's playing with numbers, pitch FX and stuff, and Sickles is just to the point where he feels like he, one, can't keep up because so much of it is math and physics and science, and two, that it just doesn't interest him because his word was it's a lot of granular researching things like, I don't know, like your post the other day, Jojima versus Johnson pitch framing, which is really interesting. Actually, that's a horrible example. Man, that's relevant knowledge.
Yeah, so more like the evaluating team's non-stolen bases, base running skills in order to squeeze out one or two more runs.
Yeah. Or, you know, the win probability effect of if you should, the break-even rate for stealing a base, you know, that kind of thing, where it's all this, like, spending 3 hours to analyze a single in-game decision that wouldn't have made that much of a difference. That was his post. And it, as you can imagine, drew quite a bit of the significant reaction. And I don't want to say backlash because people respect John Sickles enough that they won't just treat him as some kind of idiot, like,
it's not like a Murray Chase or Murray Chass. This is his latest tirade against the blogosphere sort of
right.
Backlash.
It's not Bob Costas, you know, ripping into that Phillies blogger, and it's not that other guy in Philadelphia who sucks, you know, the one.
Yes.
So people have been fair with Sickles, and And they've obviously responded. Whose responses I've read are the people who are doing this research, and they're basically defending themselves because that's what they do. They clearly find it interesting themselves. And there's been calls for more creative writing, more intermediaries, more Dave Camerons, less tangos or pizza cutters, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
More people to explain all the research in common people terms.
Better writers,
yeah. And so I guess that's a summary. So that's actually not a summary of what I wrote at all. So my response was that Sickles clearly has a number of things that he's interested in. He's interested in prospect analysis and the best ways to analyze their numbers in the minors, because they're dealing with different stuff than we have for the major leagues. You know, there is no pitch FX for the minors. So he's trying to wade through all of the stuff out there to try to find stuff that suits him, that's interesting to him. And my post was basically taking another angle where, unlike Sickles, I'm not just interested in this small window of analysis. I'm interested in everything. You know, I spent 45 minutes this morning reading about the Mets catching situation. I know who Josh Thole is now, by the way. So we can't, our 40-man roster rundown can't be the Mets, because I know all about it now. I know how bad Omer Santos is. Wow.
Well, we could push the Mets off for a month. I'm sure by then Omar Minaya will have overhauled another 15 spots.
Omer Santos is bad. he's the new Noel Lowry.
Was he the person who was supposed to be their catcher?
He has a minor league OPS of 650 in his career. He's like 28 years old. He came up last year, got 300 at bats, and he was bad. And then the Mets were like, we want you to start this year in front of Henry Blanco because he's bad, but not as bad as you. And we're the Mets, so we don't do things that make sense. We do things that we want to do. And that's
Omer Santos. What happened to Brian Schneider?
Brian Schneider was a free agent. He went to Philadelphia, I think, for 2 years. And he's also a catcher who's better than all of their catchers.
Right.
So the community knows they are now looking at Rod Barajas, who last year had an OPB of 258.
That's not good.
No.
No, that's, wow.
How? Which might be higher than Omer Santos' minor league OBP, I'm not sure.
Rod Barajas should back up Jason Kendall. Or he might be trumping, that might trump Jason Kendall, actually. Actually, that probably does trump Jason. I guess it would depend on how much they pay him. But
I think all four of the catchers that the Mets have in camp trump Jason Kendall.
Right, but none of them are getting paid $3 million, right?
Right, no.
So, 2 years. Yeah. I don't know. This is a fascinating. This actually, I know it started out sort of a tongue-in-cheek thing, but this back and forth between the Mets and the Royals this offseason is actually, it's becoming like this self-fulfilling internet meme. It's as if cats really did start talking in stupid baby voices.
And the Astros are like, let me play. Sign Brandon Lyon. Whoops, now he has a shoulder problem. He has a fist in his shoulder, by the way. He's going to be delayed.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. Assist.
Oh, I guess that brings up a good point. We ended the last podcast with the news that the Astros were looking into signing Willie Taveras, much to my delight and humor. It turns out they didn't, and instead, the Nationals came through. Because God knows, if the Astros pass on somebody, you really, really want to get in on that action.
I put this on Twitter a couple days ago, but what I love is that Willie Taveras is going to be coming to camp and competing for the same job as Chris Duncan, it's like, so we want a speedy fourth outfielder who can back up all the positions and bunt.
Yeah, that's a weird. I wonder how they're going to judge that.
Actually, Chris Duncan came up in the big cap. We got completely sidetracked from what we were talking about before. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Just back on the Astros and the Nationals now. I guess this is going to be our go-to topic.
The National League is just this black hole of stuff to talk about. So I guess, yeah, let's try and get back on the subject.
So that post, man.
Yeah, the post. Huh.
So this would be a good example, actually, of the stuff that just sidetracks you. Like, I am fascinated by the fact that Willie Taveras was traded by Cincinnati to Oakland and immediately DFA'd, then rumored to be going to the Astros, and then he signed for the Nationals. That interests me. I don't know why. Willie Taveras is going to make no impact on the major leagues ever. He sucks. He's terrible. He's a bad baseball player relative to baseball players, not even just professional ones. And he's in Washington now, and that's interesting. So I want to when I saw the news that he signed with Washington, I wanted to find out, well, where is he going to fit in? So I found out about the Chris Duncan thing, and I thought, that's weird. That doesn't make any sense at all. And so it's just things like that happen all the time, and I'm interested in roster moves, in roster demands, what GMs are doing, what GMs want to do, and then that's just the surface of it. You know, that's the major league roster management that anybody can follow. But then you have all the research that's going on. You have all these different, you know, projection systems. You have people trying to perfect defense. You learn terms like bins and continuous functions for defense, and it's just all this stuff. And, you know, like when I'm going through Wikipedia, because I also link Chase there when I have a free 10 minutes, I'm like, I want to learn everything.
Right.
And in baseball, it's the same way, but for some reason, my head thinks you can learn everything. It's true, because baseball has infinite knowledge, just like the world has infinite knowledge, but I still have this compulsion to learn and stay. So there's a Scrubs episode that I watched many years ago, because I watched Scrubs, because Scrubs was good once, and if anybody watches it now, you're a fucking retard, because it's terrible, and the entire cast is different. But there was a good episode many years ago where I think it was, who was that guy? Well, I don't remember the name. There's an old doctor who was a friend of the chief of medicine, and he came to the hospital, and he was doing all these outdated procedures, and the chief of medicine was like, why are you doing this? Medicine has passed you by. So that's your plot summary. Sorry for the spoilers. Because there was this old doctor who was just stuck with the knowledge that he learned growing up, and then he never adapted, he never evolved. And I think, well, I don't want to be that kind of baseball fan or baseball writer. You know, I don't want to be Murray Chass, Chase, Murray C, MC. You know, I want to stay on top of things. And there are just so many places that you have to go to if you want to do that, because it is important. You have to know what research has been done. Otherwise, if you ever do research of your own, you're just reinventing the wheel. Or I guess if it's insignificant research, you're reinventing the
square
pencil?
Before the wheel.
The number three pencil. Is there a number three pencil?
There probably is.
Reinventing the number three pencil. Because the number two does everything you want. Everybody uses the number two. No test is like, well, you can use a two or you can use a three. Because nobody cares about the number three pencil. So,
yeah, why do we even call it a number two pencil?
Was it the number one that sucked?
Do you think?
Number one, number two is made of graphite, right?
Yes.
I think number one is probably made of plutonium. Like, oh, we can't hold these. This is glowing pencil ink is really confusing for the children. And then we have
it's prohibitively expensive.
Why do we make $10 million pencils? Oh, shit. Mine broke.
Although if they ever figured out the eraser on that thing, that would have done some good.
Yeah, painting eraser factory Chernobyl needs you. One time when I was a kid, I was using a pencil as a walking stick, and I used the wrong side of the pencil on my hand, so it didn't work very well.
That seemed like it wouldn't work on multiple levels, but I don't want to get into how long your pencil was.
I was one of the smartest kids in my school. So there's just so much to keep up with, and I know you can relate because you have written at Hardball Times, you write on Fangraphs, you write on Look at Landing, you're always participating too. It's not like I'm unique. This is the struggle for a lot of people, you know. I'm not the only person who has a compulsion to learn. I write, which makes it a little more difficult, but I also don't have a family or a life, so it's easier for me. It's just, John Sickles might not realize he has it easy. If he's only interested in things that affect prospect analysis, then that just wipes off like 85% of the stuff that's going on out there. Keeping up with everything is hard and stressful.
Yeah, I don't know if he has it that much easier, because you think about how much of the minor leagues that we ignore because we don't give a crap. I know we both kind of feel the same way about the minor leagues, that we don't really start looking until about AA or start taking numbers seriously. So just the sheer number of leagues and I'm sure he does like high school and college scouting and international scouting stuff as well. Mm-hmm. It's probably less topics, so there might be less brain power expended in terms of grasping new ideas and new concepts, and that is tiring. But the scope of what he probably looks at in baseball is, I would say, probably larger than, at least in mine.
Yeah. Well, I guess I shouldn't diminish. I mean, he's covering every prospect in baseball. He has a lot on his plate. He doesn't have it easy. He just, most of the research out there, just, it means nothing to him, you know? There's fewer people researching what he's interested in, which means less to read.
Obviously, yeah, it struck me in a way that I can obviously relate to. And the interesting, what I was going to comment about is that even if you sort of managed to build up filters for yourself and be like, okay, well, I'm not going to follow the book blog religiously. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to read every post on Fangraphs. I'm not going to read every post on Hardball Times, etc. And I'll just kind of count on the meaningful posts getting linked to often enough or getting discussed often enough that eventually I'll find out about it. That's one way, you know, you can sort of try to stay up to date and commit, cut down on your time commitment. The problem is, I think we just as people, it's not like we reclaim that lost time and then put it to some other use. It just kind of gets filled with another interest. So any time that I save on, any time I save by not reading every comment on the book blog, I then spend reading about hockey transactions or reviews of travel locations or what beers are getting released this week or what's happening in politics. And don't even get me started about politics, because that's baseball times some number larger than one in terms of information that you can just keep reading. You take, it's, there's less maybe research about politics, but you compare the number of people that write about politics compared to the number of people that write about advanced baseball, and oh my God, I mean, there's just, you could spend all day just reading and keeping up to date on what's going on, and that's, you know, that's not even the research stuff. And there is political research, political science articles, economic articles, things, obviously delving into the details behind policies, and that's a whole nother, I mean, those are entirely different disciplines. So I don't know, it's overwhelming. And one thing I will say that what's tough about it is that if you want to be one of those people that's on the cutting edge, if you want to be, to put it bluntly, if you want to be great, society doesn't really afford people in this day and age the opportunity to be great and well-rounded. You look at professional athletes, you look at anybody who's at the top of their field in anything, for the most part, that's what they do. And it gets me back to one of my little pet peeves I have about evaluating baseball players, and people talk about, oh, like Jose Lopez is lazy, or I mean, people have, for the most part, no idea how much work these people put in, both throughout their entire life and today, you know, maybe not today, but on any given baseball day, they're probably out there doing 4, 5, 6 hours of work related to baseball that the public never sees or hears about. Studying film, practicing swings in the batting cage, fielding routine grounders in infield practice, base running, working out, exercising. That stuff doesn't get... If you're lazy, you don't do that. Now, to an extent, I can understand that they probably say, like, oh, Jose Lopez... When they say Jose Lopez is lazy, they probably mean, well, like, Jose Lopez is lazier than insert some other MLB player. And now that's true. Not all MLB players, not all anything in any field, people don't have the same motivation level. But I think sometimes people lose sight of just how far away from lazy anybody who actually makes the major leagues is. And we sort of kind of really narrow our focus on the gap between, I don't know who was on the Mariner, like an Edgar Martinez in terms of preparation and a Jose Lopez, and they blow up that gap, when really the gap between those two is probably way smaller than the gap between Jose Lopez and the average person listening to us talk right now.
Yeah, you fat fuck.
Get on a treadmill. That's what podcasts are for. You should be downloading this and running to it.
God, you're lazy.
Faster.
You are greasy and disgusting. Ugh, can't even look at you. I need kettle chips. That's actually, I had a point I wanted to make, then I forgot it, then brought back up. So it's the well-rounded thing actually drives me crazy sometimes, when I'll sit back and I realize, oh shit, all I know about is baseball and volcanoes. I need to learn something about something. And then I'll just start link chasing on Wiki about politics or chemistry, you know, because that was my degree. Or just things where I try to, like, round myself better on Wikipedia in like half an hour a day.
Yeah.
Like, it's completely imbalanced. And it's like, man, if I didn't have a girlfriend, I don't know what I would say to meet women. Like,
right. Hey. No, that's exactly the, like, you know, because you want to try and not just obviously not just for flirting, but just in general social interactions. There's also the whole, I mean, there's music, there's popular culture, movies, TV shows, books that come out, all this sort of stuff, and there's just so much information nowadays. It comes so much faster that it is really easy to get overwhelmed. Now, on the other hand, there's, and a lot of people do lament just how fast, skirting the edge of politics a little bit, but even it's relevant in sports too. People talk about the 24-hour news cycle now and how that's really changed journalism and reporting, and that there's just, you know, there's more news reporting, but there's not necessarily more news. So we end up with things like Around the Horn and a boy not actually in a hot air balloon ending up on CNN for an hour and a half. I'm struggling to think about how I want to link this, but now, so it's true, there's a lot more reporting going on, and there's a lot more information out there. But what's interesting is some studies on, I think it's in like neuroscience studies or whatever, have shown that humans, we actually have the capacity to kind of amp up our brain speed. We actually are able to process a lot more of this information that's come on these 24-hour news cycles. And it's kind of allows us to learn more, or at least learn faster than people kind of gave us credit for in the past. And what was frustrating for me, I remember reading about this, and I was trying to pull this up for this podcast. It's called it's related to the Filer Faster Thesis. It's F-E-I-L-E-R, Faster Thesis, or FFT for short. And as a hint to anybody out there, if you're just randomly searching for FFT, you're never gonna find this, because you're gonna get 7,000 links about Fast Furious Transforms. I'm just like, yes, that's also interesting, but that's not what I'm looking for right now. And then it was an hour later because I ended up link searching off Wikipedia.
Well, now I want to talk about nuclear magnetic resonance.
Sweet. Let's go.
Do you like hydrogen?
I love hydrogen. I took a class on astrophysics in college and basically spent the better part of 3 months learning all about the nuclear chaining and inside of suns and such, and so... No, I do find it fascinating, and I don't want to spend 30 minutes of a podcast talking about it.
Well, that isn't at all what I was talking about, but that's cool.
Well, you mentioned, you say nuclear and you say hydrogen, and that's where I'm going to go.
So Japan.
Right, Japan. What?
Edit.
No, that's fine. Anyway, so a point that you brought up, getting back to the post, is that, and all that stuff, that's just the reading part. That's just the staying up to date. Then there's the whole contributing aspect. There's the writing, which takes an enormous amount of time. It takes much more time now than it used to, because you have to be accurate in everything that you do, and not that that's a bad thing, but it is. There are times when you can write what I feel like is an insightful and persuasive piece, and if you get one thing, not even necessarily wrong, not a fact wrong, but if you word it in such a way that somebody thinks is wrong, that can end up derailing the entire discussion flow about the article, which is an enormously frustrating thing. That's, for me, that's probably the most hated part about writing for me, is when I have a 1,000-word article, and I'm not the greatest use of language out there, I know, so there are times that I screw up, and if I don't, you know, even if I have the fact right in my head, I phrase it in such a way that it comes off wrong or it gets misinterpreted. And then that's all the discussion is about, some 5-word throwaway phrase that's, you know, might even be not even related to the main thrust of the post. And it's just like, God, people, can we not? Okay, we get it. Or, yeah, I used too many commas. I didn't need this phrase. Or, yeah, oh, I made a typo. Anyways, that's my little pet peeve about writing. But
I think it's I'm starting to understand. So people have complained about, people who work for ESPN, who cover all the teams, the whole league, like, why he got this detail wrong. He clearly doesn't know anything about my team. So I read a lot of Keith Law, and I follow Keith Law on Twitter and everything. So people complain about Keith Law for getting things wrong, or maybe being argumentative, or maybe generally being less informed than a fan of an individual team. But Keith Law, he is a baseball writer. He reviews books. He reads like a new book every day. He reviews food. Like, he's a food critic. Keith Law is, and he's married, by the way. He might even have kids. Hell if I know. Little Blue Jay kids. And Keith Law seems like all the music, and he's a pretty well-rounded person. At least he conveys that image. And he's so well-rounded that his knowledge of each individual field falls short, leaving him vulnerable and susceptible to critiques from within that field, because it's now impossible to be well-rounded and informed to such a degree that people won't just blast you, because if anybody who is well-rounded will be exceeded by somebody who's not in any particular field. So it just becomes this thing like, well, you can't blame Keith Law, but maybe he shouldn't hold such a position because he is lesser informed because of his other interests. And just this thing, it's like, do you want to be good or do you want to be happy?
Right. And, well, it's kind of like, well, what do you want ESPN to do? Do you want them to hire four people like Keith Law to write about baseball? Or should they hire 30 people to cover each individual team plus, you know, five guys to cover the minor, you know? If they want to be the best, and I'm not going to say that they shouldn't do this way, I kind of think they almost should do more of this sort of path because they're ESPN and they have a hell of a lot of money. Mm-hmm. If you want to be on the cutting edge, then you kind of have to hire a lot of staff because you have to specialize. It's just kind of a basic economic theory of comparative advantage and trade and all that kind of stuff. In order to raise the level, you need specialists. I mean, you look at how many people. I think every single day we hire a new writer at Fangraphs. So that's the goal there. That's clear. But I don't. ESPN has a tougher job, and so I understand where the criticisms come from, like you said. But having worked with some of these people and talked with some of these people, I think I've become a lot more sympathetic to their standing as well, mm-hmm. and. Where, I don't know, I guess I'm kind of moved past the point where we need to blast people for, oh, look how uninformed this was. Unless it's a truly just horrendous. If it's poorly written and misinformed and takes on an holier-than-thou tone, then yeah, rip the guy to shreds, because there's no need to take that. I can't stand that sort of writing attitude, mm-hmm. especially when you're wrong and you write poorly.
Here's a list of people who have been wrong recently.
So,
I think like
So would you call that the most challenging thing about writing is this unending need to cover every detail and to make sure every
bases.
Yeah.
Yeah, making sure that everything you write only has one interpretation is well, I guess my greatest challenge kind of depends on my mood or what I'm writing about. But I did want to say one other thing on the previous topic. Like, I already used Keith Law. Let's use Buster Olney. If somebody calls out, let's say Buster Olney says something about the Yankees, as he always does, and then it might be a little misinformed, and then someone's like, no, Buster Olney's wrong. Here's why. And then somebody goes into some study to show that Buster Olney was wrong, or maybe just less right about something, and then comes up with a conclusion. Then Buster Olney started a dialogue that, in the end, led to the truth, led to some presumably original research, and that serves a purpose. You know, he contributes to the dialogue, and maybe journalists in that position where they're covering a lot of teams should just be the starting point.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. There needs to be probably more of respect held to the distinction between somebody who's a journalist and somebody who's an analyst. Mm-hmm. An analyst is not a journalist. A journalist is not an analyst. There are some people that could dabble in both, but again, once you start doing that, you're becoming more well-rounded, and then you're less of an analyst, and you're less of a journalist. So, again, specialization.
Necessary evil, I guess.
Yeah.
If you want to understand anything, you need specialists, and those specialists are going to be unpleasant, unhappy people like us.
Right. So thinking about kind of the process of writing, this was a good suggestion from the LL thread.
By the way, you guys, that was a really good thread. We got a lot of ideas.
Yeah, that was. That was a thank you to the people who contributed good ideas.
Yeah, so we're not going to put up another thread because you guys might just fuck up next week. So we'll keep these ideas in for a little bit.
Except for the ones that we're going to talk about right now.
Except for those.
Yeah. Including
segue.
Writing. I don't remember who posted the comment, and I'm not going to look it up, but thank you.
I don't know. It might have been Mark. I'll give credit to Mark.
No, this one was not Mark. This was, no, it was the Senator. Senators? Yeah, anyways, thank you,
whoever you are.
And I probably, anyways, a couple kind of direct questions about the writing process on Lookout Landing and in general, and I don't know if you wanted to just kind of like go over them piecemeal or try to stitch a coherent, flowing narrative out of it, but we kind of talked about it already for the past 10 minutes about challenges when it comes to writing, but I guess on the flip side, are there any, what's the benefits or what are the good parts about writing that you feel?
Good parts about writing, well, I mean, if I want to go super general, super broad, the best thing about me writing, the best thing to ever come out of this is the fact that, you know, well, I can do a podcast like this, people will listen, I can go to an event twice a year with the friggin' front office and shake their hands and talk to 500 people. There's just so much, and I've met so many awesome people and some less awesome people out of the website that, you know, my writing is pretty much completely shaped. My life is determined my life path and the people I know, the people I meet. So in that regard, writing has been everything to me. It's not always easy, but nothing is. And if something is always easy, that probably means you're not doing it right.
Yeah. How long? Now, obviously, at least for me, this completely varies on what I'm writing. Mm-hmm. But how long would you say a post generally takes?
Really depends on the kind of post. Like, if I'm doing, say, a fun fact, that usually takes, I don't know, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, depending on the statistical nature. I never write a post that takes less than, you know, 15 or 20 minutes, no matter what it is. Even, like, the fan shot I put up this morning, like a linked fan shot, I had to come up with something, because I don't just ever want to have a sentence that's like, hey, here's a link, read it, cool. You know, I want everything, every sentence I write to have some sort of meaning or interest, which yeah. Actually might be the challenge, you know, making sure, I don't know how to write, how do I put this in a way that doesn't sound haughty? Like, I have read people who are worse writers than me, and I don't know if I can write like them, which means I don't know if I can write faster, because I am set in my process, and my process happens to be very punctilious and pedantic and detail-oriented, and I hate typos. Tej, Travis, used to email me every so often, like, hey, I don't want to be a dick, but this should have been A instead of N. And I'd be like, oh, God, thanks. And I wouldn't be sarcastic. I'd sincerely be thankful because I hate typos and little mistakes because I am that much into the details. And that makes it hard.
That was my first job on Lookout Landing, fixing your typos behind your back.
You did good work.
Now I create many more of them.
And I fix yours, intern.
Yeah, I will say, well, so you're saying what you don't want to do is throw up a post that has, like, a sentence of, hey, we don't have any ideas, so suggest some ideas.
Yeah. like a podcast suggestion thread.
That would just be a terrible, terrible post.
I don't ever want to write anything that's boring or just seems worthless. You know, even a throwaway point, I want to be something that makes somebody smile or think. So my posts take longer than they may seem on the out. Well, some posts seem like they take forever, and some posts don't. Like the post I threw up the other day about Safeco splits probably took just as long as people think it did because of all the numbers in it. People see numbers and think, oh, man, those numbers must have taken forever, and it's usually true.
Yeah, that's probably a fair generalization, right, that narrative-type posts, for example, the one that you wrote about being overwhelmed, that probably takes, well, I guess it's different buckets of time, but I would think overall that probably takes less time than a standard stat-related post, at least to me.
It's a narrative post. So there was that post I put up a couple weeks ago about catcher defense and how we can't measure it, but if it's there, it's probably significant, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a thought, and I just sat down and I rambled. That didn't take very long. A post like today, I figure it's probably going to be linked. People are going to read it. It contributes to a greater discussion. I should spend some time. So I outlined it a little bit, and it took about an hour and a half, 2 hours. Something like the Felix Emotion and Reason posts late last year, took probably 2 or 3 hours to write, not counting the time that I would just, like, think up something during the day and jot it down. So with posts like that, like the Felix ones, I'll occasionally, very occasionally, come up with an idea and kind of mull it over in my head for a few days if I think it's going to be a really important post, even if it's not really numbers-based, because I don't want to screw it up. I want to make sure that I have all my bases covered, that I'm right, that I believe what I'm saying, because sometimes I'll write things. That's a lie. Why did you say that?
My worst part is where I start drafting a post because I have the idea in my mind, and then I go off to do the research, and the research comes out either the opposite or more often it just completely – there's no pattern to be found, and I'm just like, oh. And inevitably, those are always like my best intros. I'm like, I don't want to waste this. This is going to be the best thing I write for a week.
So you just keep it and say, psych, research.
Yeah.
So it's the time spent, time acquired. Actually, I would say my general post time is usually between 90 and 180 minutes. And that excludes things like fun facts or things that are obviously short.
Right. Do you usually think, like, oh, it's been a while since I posted something, I should post a fun fact? Or is that generally come out of, like, you're playing around on Baseball Reference and you notice something?
Well, actually, those are kind of related. Like, I will feel guilty, like, oh, man, I haven't posted for 20 minutes. I need to put something up here. So I will sometimes just play around with Baseball Reference because it's amazing. I would marry Baseball Reference if I could. So hopefully that's down a slippery slope. Eventually you'll be able to marry websites. But I can't do that now, so I will do that for fun, that's also my go-to place, that and Fangraphs. If I feel guilty, I should post something, and there's always something to post about. Like that thing I told you the other day, the Major League batting average on balls in play last June was .289, in August it was .306. That's weird, why did that happen?
.289
over a whole month.
Oh, wow. So it was a 17-point swing?
Yeah, it was a 17-point swing between
June and August, right? That's huge over a league.
Yeah, no idea what causes that. Anyway, so yeah, fun facts don't take very long, but game recaps, obviously you can tell which game recaps take a while and which ones don't, but those I obviously don't think about ahead of time. I'll just I don't plan posts ahead of time very often. Except I've noticed I outline a little more now because I know that my memory sucks and I want to be thorough. But one of the questions was, how often do you get an idea and immediately post about it versus how often do you get an idea and work on it for a couple days or weeks? I don't work on posts for that long. I don't have a Derek Zumsteg chemistry post that he worked on and then submitted for editing and then put up a while later.
Yeah.
Mine are refined because I self-edit, but there's nothing that I sit on for days and days.
Yeah, the closest I think I come to that is my version of jotting things down in a notebook when I have just like a random idea is just to create a draft story in our little dashboard thing for writing and then just save it and go about my business. Mm-hmm. And occasionally when I, like you, have thought like, I haven't actually hit publish on something in a while, I go into my draft folder and see, oh yeah, I had an idea about writing about Kenji Judgma versus Rob Johnson framing. Okay, well let me flesh that out, and that ended up taking like 400,000 hours. But there are times when humorously I look back on that and it's things like a post I wrote in advance of Russell Branyan re-signing. I'm like, whoops. Or a post that, I guess what actually did happen this offseason, I wrote a post about, actually this happened twice, I wrote a post about Rich Harden and a post about Joel Piniero, both when they were free agents. Mm-hmm. And I had it all pretty much drafted, and I was like, okay, I want to give this, I'm going to sleep on it, and I'm going to come back tomorrow, I'm going to polish it up a little bit more. And both times I woke up and they had signed. And I was just like, God damn it.
Just force the post anyway.
Yeah, so then you're just kind of left with, I don't want to scrap it. I've already invested time versus how much of this do I have to change?
Oh, I should. So this is a good reminder. So the readers know, if there's something that we work on, we will force a post out of it.
Oh, yeah.
There's no such thing as 3 hours of work that goes unposted. There will be something, or we'll just lie, or, you know, if... Like, you can go ahead. You can explain your Panera posts.
Well, yeah, so what ended up happening is I wrote the focus on the article was, can Joel Piniero make sense for the Mariners? Basically, in a situation that or very similar to the post that Dave Cameron wrote about Jared Washburn.
Mm-hmm.
And just because I felt like Joel Pinheiro, because of his baggage here in Seattle, wasn't going to get a fair shake amongst, you know, your gut reaction when you hear Joel Pinheiro. And this happened to me, too. It's like, you know, there are people that I just don't want to see pitch again, and Joel Pinheiro is one of them for my team anyways.
Yeah.
But I was like, well, it was up until a day later. It was a particularly slow week of the offseason, so I was like, well, this is something worth exploring and see how much of his 2009 was a fluke, how much we want to regress it back. And I went through all through this and what would be a fair contract for him, kind of outlining it in the Cliff Lee, Felix Hernandez hypothetical contract extension posts, and came up with a bunch of things. And then I don't remember exactly what happened, but yeah, literally that night or that morning, it broke that he signed with the Angels. And no, I wasn't going to just scrap it. I'm not going to hit delete. I still have that Russell Branyan resigns post in my draft folder. I'm not getting rid of it until, I don't know, I guess he could resign in 2011, too, so I'm never getting rid of that. But I ended up then having to spend about an hour thinking, okay, well, how can I save what I wrote, save the research, but not be like, hey, let's all pretend it's 6 hours earlier. Because unfortunately, SB Nation will let you update times and dates of posts, but it won't let you set it backwards. Be like, no, I post. Your internet must be wrong.
SB Nation now operated by NBC and posting on tape delay.
Right.
Yesterday.
So my resolution was to keep all the and basically just sort of turn it into a. Well, investigate the sort of contract he should have gotten or he was worth. Change, you know, the tense from future tense to past tense, and then just evaluate the Angels, the contract that he did get. And luckily, it's because he signed with the Angels, it was relevant enough, I felt, to post on Lookout Landing. If he had signed with the Reds, I probably would have had to eat that post, because I just don't think it would have felt weird. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I'm gonna, here's 1,000 words on the Reds signing Joel Pinheiro. Luckily, thank God, it was the Angels.
Joel Pinheiro in Cincinnati will be teammates with another guy.
Yeah.
And this name. He'll be teammates with Reds.
So are there... You've mentioned to me a couple times how much you enjoy writing like those mid-season posts every year where you compare Mariners to various things. Is that... just generally those types of creative posts, the ones that you think you get the most enjoyment out of writing, or the kind of research posts where you kind of you actually find something out?
I don't think I've actually ever found anything out that's really important. My research is very like
well, none of us
school
have,
level.
None of us have really found anything important. It takes
well, yeah, but I mean, you've done like the Johnson Georgima framing posts. Those are really cool and also beyond my current capabilities. So I consider you a far better researcher and scientist than I am. I'm just a guy who knows a couple numbers. The creative posts are definitely the most fun, but you should understand no post is fun to write. Even when I was writing my recap of Felix's one-hitter in Boston, writing is not the fun part. The fun part is the ideas that you get, and then finishing the post, hitting publish, being like, yes! And then seeing feedback, maybe not necessarily reading the feedback, because sometimes it's not what you want it to be, but just seeing, like, I don't know, the retweets climb, or the Facebook wall posts, or links coming in, traffic, and just the satisfaction of writing something that's really creative, and then maybe a couple years later looking back and be like, yeah, that was funny, or, man, I'm glad people forgot about this.
Right.
Like
or at least some people forgot about it.
Some people forgot. Yeah, Robert, God damn it. The mid-season posts are a lot of fun. They're stressful. Like, last year I woke up the morning of and I thought, oh, shit, I need an idea.
Right.
Well, something came to me because I was just driving to work and I thought, oh, this is convenient. I'll compare mirrors to things that happen to you when you're going to work. This is an idea, but sometimes you're feeling creative, sometimes you're not. So it's the thrill is getting the idea and getting ideas from there for, you know, like the individual paragraphs. And it's fun to be creative. It's just now that we're so stressed out looking through all the news, it's hard to sit down and find the time to be creative because very rarely, let's see, so sometimes creativity strikes. Like, any fake conversation I've posted on Lookout Landing, you know the ones.
Yeah.
Those have all been spur of the moment. You can't plan one of those and have it be funny. I'm convinced. It's impossible. You can't sit down and be like, how can I make Carlos Silva talk to Rick Adair in such a way that people will find it humorous and deliver Ricks? That's not how it works. It just comes to you like that, or the Kenji Jojima, a peculiar comment post.
Right.
You know, I was at work and I saw that and I thought, well, that's a weird thing to say. Oh my God, a brain idea. Well, it's a brain idea, but creativity is really hard to plan.
Or force.
Yeah, forced creativity leads to really, really bad fake conversations.
Yeah. I totally just blanked on what I was going for while you were talking. Woo!
Well, so, yeah, never mind.
Oh, that's right, okay. So, yeah, because I think one of those things where I was going for with the question is, it seems like they're probably more fun or rewarding or interesting to write because they are so creative, but on the other hand, now you've kind of built up this expectation of creativity, and knowing you and the way that you're self-critical about your writing, those probably take all the more time to edit because you want to make sure, oh, my phrasing is just the right way to get the most laughs.
The phrasing actually comes... This is one of those things. I don't know if people realize how critical wordplay can be if you're going for something funny. Like, there are just... Well, we don't need to talk about that. I'm not a comedian, for God's sake. But I actually think I edit those creative pieces less because if I'm doing something that's numbers-based, I'll be... At heart, I'm a scientist. You know, I majored in science. I've done experiments. I want everything to be controlled. I want everything to be correct. Whereas if you're doing something creative, nobody can analyze a post that compares the Simpsons to the... Or the Mariners to the Simpsons, you know? People can disagree, but then it's fun. It's a fun disagreement. Whereas if you're having a scientific disagreement, it sucks. It's like, oh, you're wrong, or shit, I forgot the control for that.
Yeah.
So that part, well, you probably too. It's just you have to be a lot more vigilant when you're editing and making sure you did something right. Whereas with a creative post, whatever, it's fun. It's creativity. Creativity can't be analyzed.
That's a different answer than I would have expected, but... Well, and now it's got me thinking. If I generally stay away from the creative posts for the most part. But one of the things that I'm wondering is, am I more afraid of posting something that's statistically or scientifically wrong, or would I be more afraid of posting something that is clearly like attempting to be a creative post and is flat out not funny? I don't know what would embarrass myself more, what I would be more ashamed of if I got something completely wrong or I was not funny.
Well, I can
was trying to be funny.
It would be worse for you if you did something that's wrong statistically because that's what you've built your reputation on, and it would be worse for me if you did something that wasn't funny because people will think I wrote it. Like, wow, Jeff, that really dropped flat. You should have changed your name from Jeff to Jeff Sullivan. It ruined the tone. So there's your answer.
Well, objectively, I agree, but I'm just trying to evaluate my own sort of internal processes. Yeah, reputation-wise, it would be more harmful for me to post something statistically stupid. But I don't know. There's probably – I think there's a sort of selection bias there in that the people that would generally – the people that figure out that it's stupid are – how do I put this without insulting everybody? If I post something statistically wrong, a statistician might notice it, but not 100% of people will notice it. Mm-hmm. If I post something that tries to be funny and isn't funny, I feel like a far greater percentage of people are gonna be like, "Well, that post sucked."
Well, yeah, but then you're relying on these universal standards of humor, which clearly don't exist, given that 2.5 Men is America's number one comedy.
Yeah,
2.5 Men.
I would feign outrage over that, but it probably took the title of most watched comedy over something else that was really retarded.
It's not even 2.5 Men anymore. The kid's fat. It's like 3.5 Men.
I think the kid was always kind of fat.
Yeah, he was always kind of fat. John Cryer's no, sorry, that's offensive.
And the kid's dad's barely a man.
I forgot which one is his dad? The kind of gay sounding one or the one
not Charlie Sheen
girlfriend?
Not Charlie Sheen one.
Charlie Sheen is a likable character. I can't believe that. God, watch How I Met Your Mother or Community or Surgical Drama.
That's not an actual show, right?
Well, that's not the name of it, but it's a genre.
Okay. Oja, okay.
Or Volcano.
Yeah.
Volcano's funny. It's not a show, but I wish it were on every day. You know what lava melts? Everything.
Yeah. So compare and contrast Volcano to Dante's Peak.
Oh my god, no, not even. I saw Dante's Peak 4 times in the first 4 days with 4 different friends in theaters. Dante's Peak was incredible. I know it's kind of bad, but Volcano's just good enough to not be the fun kind of bad. It's like, oh god, that's really bad. But Dante's Peak is like, oh, they're driving away from a volcanic explosion because cars could do that.
Yeah.
Really. And you know how I am with volcanoes. And the volcano in Volcano, well, this is a weird way to say it. The volcano in Volcano was just spitting lava out of the ground. But the volcano in Dante's Peak was like straight up St. Helens explosion. And it's awesome. And I don't know how the lady guided a boat to the dock in acid water, because that's really not realistic at all. But at least it's a scientifically sound concept. Like, yeah, the water's acid now because the volcano is exploding with shit from the ground. So that part was really cool. The eruption was really cool. The data was pretty cool. Volcano's just a pile of shit. I don't know why I like it. I don't know why I remember it. Dante's Peak was amazing. It's the only good thing Pierce Brosnan's ever done. And I would watch it.
Whoa, there. Goldeneye?
You know how I am with volcanoes. I cannot have a reason.
No, but okay, but it's not. You can be irrational and love volcanoes and still admit that Pierce Brosnan has been in another good movie.
Yeah, no, but that was a creative point, not a scientific point.
Okay, sorry.
You can analyze. Pierce Brosnan's done a lot of good stuff. He's done a lot of bad stuff. Dante's Peak was amazing. Actually, I kind of hated Pierce Brosnan's character. I just like the Mountain. So the Mountain did a really good job in the movie.
Superb acting. You know what that movie needed? Jeff Goldblum.
That's true.
It needed Jeff Goldblum's character from Jurassic Park. You know what? Every movie needs Jeff Goldblum's character from Jurassic Park.
And every movie doesn't need the children character from Jurassic Park 3.
Or 2. Or 1.
You know, movies shouldn't have kids anymore unless they die. You know what should have happened in Dante's Peak was kids should have died. That's what happens when volcanoes erupt, because kids can't get away as fast as adults. Kids can't drive. Although a kid did drive in Dante's Peak, incidentally. Looking weird.